James 2:14 through 2:20. The 10th talk in a series on James was presented by Ron Julian on March 12, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in Chapter 2 of James, picking up where we were a couple weeks ago. I jumped into the middle of the section, Chapter 2, verses 14 through 26, to talk about the story of Abraham, because I thought it was important to spell out the whole story. There's actually a lot involved in what James is appealing to in the few verses that he talks about Abraham. What I want to do this morning is back up to verse 14, and let's go through the whole section then and see what it is that James is saying. So, chapter 2, verse 14, "What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith but has no works? That faith cannot save him, can it? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, be warmed and be filled,' and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, 'You have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works.' You believe that God is one. You do well. The demons also believe and shudder. But are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled which says, 'And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And he was called the friend of God.' You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead." Okay, so what we see in this section is a whole series of little analogies and explanations. We're jumping from one to the other here. Each of them, I kind of picture, we have the topic of faith and works, and James comes at it from this direction, and then he comes at it from this direction, sort of triangulating in on it, trying to paint this picture of how they're connected. And he starts with a question. What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith, but he has no works? That faith cannot save him, can it? Now, up until this point, James has not explicitly used the word works much. It's cropped up a little bit. But the issue of faith and works has been very much a part of his letter, because what he has been talking about is the testing of our faith. In other words, he's been talking about the fact that God puts us through situations, puts us through trials that force us to live out what we believe. So trials are God's very practical way of making the connection between faith and works. What I believe, I am going to ultimately be called upon to live out, and God's going to make sure that I do. And that's what James has been talking about throughout the letter. Up until this point, James has articulated several ways in which his readers' faith has been tested in the circumstances in which they have found themselves. That is, several ways in which what the gospel says impacts how they live their lives. There are these truths that they say they have assented to, but the question is, how have they actually thought about those truths when they've had to make a decision in life based on whether those things were true? For example, in the story that the gospel tells, we know that every human being must stand before the judgment seat of God, and that ultimately it doesn't matter how much money or wealth or power or whatever you may have in this world. You're going to lose it all, and you're going to stand before God, and ultimately your destiny is going to be determined. The rich unbeliever will lose everything and be condemned. If I believe the gospel story, then that's a part of that story. But if that is what they truly believe, then they have to wrestle with how they react to rich people, to people with money, how they react to the situation that they don't have as much as they want. And that's something that the people that James is writing to have been wrestling with mightily. The gospel story tells us that the one who has faith in God will inherit the kingdom of God. Well, if that's what they truly believe, then they have to wrestle with how they think about the poor believers in their midst. How are they going to react to them? Who do they think is really rich? If, in fact, they believe this story that the gospel tells, that it is the believer who ends up inheriting the true riches. The gospel story says that none of us is worthy of salvation. God's people are saved through the offering that Christ made on the cross on our behalf. If that's what they truly believe, that they are unworthy and God is being merciful through Christ, then they have to wrestle with how they react to others that they think of as in some way unworthy. So, the story of the gospel is something that they're called upon to believe, but what James has been saying throughout the letter is that they are called upon to believe it in the midst of their life. They are called upon to believe it as the issues of the gospel come up in the circumstances of their life. In the verse just before this section, James has said that judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. It's a very interesting passage that we looked at. He ends up talking about the law of liberty, by which I understand him to mean the gospel. And there's this irony here that in the one sense, there is this great freedom in the gospel because Jesus is doing for me what I cannot do for myself. He is making me right with God in a way that I could never do, and I still cannot do. And yet at the same time, there is a kind of a judgment that the gospel is going to make on my life. And the judgment is, have I believed it and embraced it with my life, such that I'm going to have to confront the issue, how can I see myself as an unworthy person desperately needing the mercy of God and yet refusing to be merciful to anyone else? So, right in that very section, James has raised the specter of the possibility that saying that you're a believer might actually be in tension with, in contradiction with, the actual way you're living your life. And that's what brings him, I think, to the question that he raises here. What use is it if a man says he has faith but he has no works? The issue he wants to talk about in this section is, let's just think about it from various angles. How could it be that a person could actually believe this stuff and yet live consistently as if it were not true? That's the issue that we're talking about in this section. He is not asking the question, and we want to be very clear about this, what use is it if a person says he has faith but he's a sinner and you find him doing evil things? Because if that were the question, then we're in big trouble. Because every one of us who is seeking to be justified in Christ finds sin and evil in our lives because he has faith, but in fact he does not. What use is it if a man says he has faith, but his actions are entirely the actions of an unbeliever? That's what I see him as addressing in this section. Can a man who claims to have faith and yet lives entirely a life that reflects his unbelief be saved? And James' answer is no. Faith is a reality. Now, sin is a reality as well, but faith is a real living dynamic in the life of a believer, and so it's going to have some sort of a reality somewhere, and that's what this section is about. So we turn to his first point, and just be prepared here. He jumps from point to point. He's just kind of putting a dot here and a dot here, trying to paint this picture. First, he says, if a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? In the same way, also, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. Okay, now, obviously James is very concerned with the way his readers have been responding to the poorer believers among them. They have been treating them with disrespect because they don't see them as having anything to offer. They don't have any money. They're just a problem. But I think we need to be careful here. James' point in this section is not, as I would understand it, exactly what use is a faith that doesn't feed the poor. His idea is more complex than that here. I think what he's getting at, his point here, is the difference between what we say and what we do. It sounds great. It would have been a common sort of greeting or, a salutation. Somebody's leaving. It's okay, go in peace, be warmed and be filled. I mean, sounds great. It's much better than saying, get lost. I mean, be warmed and filled. What a kindly thing to say. But if I am talking to someone that I know is in need of warmth and filling, and I say, be warmed and be filled, and then I walk away, the question arises, so what did that mean? When I said, be warmed and be filled, I was saying, it is my desire that you be warmed and filled, that you find clothing and food in response to the need that you have. And yet, I don't care enough about it to actually do anything about it. There is this disconnect between what sounds like a very loving, gracious thing and what I actually do. And I think that's the point that James is making here. That particular situation is analogous to every kind of issue that we face when our faith is tested. That his concern in this section is the one who says he has faith, who makes this claim, I'm a believer, I'm with the believers. And yet, here he's talking about, can you see, when you look at this example, how the things that I do can give the lie to the things that I say? It's an easy example to understand, very concrete. I say, be warmed and be filled, and then I leave you cold and empty. Okay, the disconnect is easy to understand. Well, James is talking about the disconnect in any number of ways between what it is we say we believe and the implications of that faith as we encounter it in life, if we refuse to confront those implications. Okay, so this one, I think, the simple idea is this disconnect between what we say and what we do. He goes on. New point. But someone may well say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without the works and I will show you my faith by my works. Okay, for some reason, it's a little bit cryptic the way James puts this. There are huge debates that go on about what it is that he's saying in this section, but I think it's pretty easy, actually. So maybe that tells you something about me, I don't know, but it seems to me pretty clear what he's getting at. James is proposing an objection to the person who claims to have faith and yet has no works. So he's saying, okay, so what are you going to do? Somebody's going to come along and say this. This objection is being raised by someone who, it's clear in the whole section, has both faith and works in their life. That is, they believe the gospel, and you can see in the way they live their life the evidence that they believe the gospel. So the objection that this person is raising seems to me to be something along these lines. Look, I know how my faith would be seen. I live as if the gospel were true. But how can the reality of your faith be seen if you have no works? That is, if you totally and completely live as if the gospel were false. I think he's proposing a thought experiment here. He's not saying our job is to go around saying, show me your faith. Okay, look, I just fed this guy over here. That means I'm a believer. What have you done recently? That's not at all what he has in mind. But I think what he's saying is, let's propose this thought experiment. I am one who believes that faith and works go together, so I know what faith looks like. What does it look like to you? You're proposing that you could be a believer and yet live as if it were not true. So what's the faith exactly then? What is that? What kind of a faith would that be where I say I believe something and every single thing that I do is screaming out, I don't believe this at all. We're very familiar with that sort of, I mean, we could think about someone who's constantly saying, you know, oh, I love you, I care about you, but in action, their actions are constantly belittling and ignoring and abusing. Someone might ask the question at that, you know, I'm sort of wondering, what do you mean by love? What is that exactly that you're talking about there? Well, I think that's the objection this person is raising. What sort of a faith would that be? A belief that is invisible. That is a belief that ultimately is successfully shielded from every single visible aspect of my life. What would that be? And I think the answer that James means them to come to is, that's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? That wouldn't be possible. In saying this, I think he's saying something that's just obvious and straightforward. There's no great theological mystery behind what it is he's saying here. This is all just relying on the commonsensical observation that when I believe something, the things that I do reflect the things that I believe. Okay, then he moves to a new point in verse 19. You believe that God is one. You do well. The demons also believe and shudder. But are you willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless? Okay, this is a new point again. And it's a little different than what he's been saying up to now, I think. We can have correct beliefs that don't necessarily reflect a fundamental change of heart toward God. God is one is one of the great statements of Jewish orthodoxy. It comes from the Old Testament passage, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And this came to be one of the great statements of faith of the Jewish people. This is what God called them to through Moses. And this is like the opening of the statement of this is who we see God, how we see God and our relationship to him. It immediately precedes the commandment to love God with all your heart and so on. So this idea that God is one is definitely a part of what we as Christians are called to believe as well. It hasn't changed. God is the one true God, the unique creator above all. He has no competition. There is no one else like him. We owe our love to him alone. But that is the point. Belief that God is one, that he is the one true God, calls us to respond in some way. It calls on me to repent. We have not lived as if God were God. We have not loved him as we should. We have not obeyed him as we should. God is one is ultimately a theological formulation that calls upon us to reevaluate ourselves. Ultimately, it leads us to Christ, who offered himself on our behalf, because we have not lived as if God is one. So it is a theological truth that calls upon me to make a personal decision about what I'm going to do about my own problem. What am I going to do about the fact that I have not lived as if this is true? It is a truth that pushes at me. Well, but he points out the truth in and of itself, the formulation, God is one, there, it's easy to believe that in a way that doesn't cost you anything. And he gives us the example, the demons. The demons believe that God is one. They would all pass a theological test on the oneness of God. They would all say true. And they would be right. And they believe it. I mean, as far as it goes, they think that's the case. But so what? That belief has not actually led them to bow the knee to God. They do not see in that truth anything that calls upon them to make any change in the way they're going. So here I think James is trying to suggest that a true biblical faith involves letting the truths of God change my view of myself and everything else. It is a truth that I have braced not just as a theological abstraction, but something that I see as telling me something about who I am and who God is and what I have to do. Okay, then we come to verse 21, shift gears again. We talked about this the last time we got together. I'm not really going to go over it again. Let me read it. Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar? You see that faith was working with his works, And as a result of the works, faith was perfected. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, "And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And he was called the friend of God." You see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. Okay, so we talked about this a lot last time. The key idea here, as I see it, is that Abraham offered up Isaac because he believed that God would keep his promise and make Isaac a great nation. It was not just, he didn't offer up Isaac because he's a bloodthirsty old man who loves killing children. He didn't offer up Isaac because he just wanted to obey God because he was afraid that God would squash him flatter than a pancake if he didn't do it. He did it because he believed the promise that God had made. It was an act of faith on his part. Before Isaac was born, Abraham was justified before God because he believed God's promise. God wasn't waiting for him to offer up Isaac to be reconciled to him, to accept him. He reckoned his faith to him as righteousness. Abraham was under the favor of God because he was a man of faith. But later in his life, when he was called to act on that faith, he actually demonstrated in his actions that it was not an empty claim that he had made earlier that he believed, that in fact you could see in the way he was living that he actually did believe the promise that God made. So James is saying, yes, we are justified by faith, but we are justified by a real faith. And a real faith shows itself in the way we live. So ultimately, we could say we are justified not by a mere faith alone, but by a faith that shows itself in the way I live. Okay, so we talked about that quite a bit last time. Then he gives another example, which is striking. "And in the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way?" This is a very interesting example. Rahab was a harlot and a liar. And in fact, the work that she did was lying about where the messengers were. They came into town. She told everybody, oh, they went that way, only they hadn't gone that way. Well, what's going on in that story? It seems to me that we see in the story, implicit in it, that Rahab had a heart for God. She alone among the people of Jericho understood who Yahweh was. The Jews were the people of Yahweh. They were going to win because Yahweh was with them. And so I think we are to understand from the story that God himself accepted Rahab. She believed in him, and she was given a place among the people of God because she believed in him. But how do we know that she believed in Yahweh? We know because she sheltered and protected the Jewish spies. She protected God's people. She looked at them and said, "These are the people that God is fighting for. I need to be on their side because I need to be on God's side." But we don't see her saying anything like that in the story. What we see her doing is acting. She protected the spies and protected them from harm. And it's through her actions that we come to know what it is ultimately that she was thinking. Why is it that she came to find a place among the people of God? Okay? Then one more. "For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead." A very striking example. Another example of the way James likes to use concrete analogies to show you what he's talking about. When we look at a dead body, we see the outward form of a person, but the inner life is gone. If any of you have ever had the opportunity to do this, you recognize that on the one hand, I'm looking at the person, the form is there, and yet at the same time, I am not. There's something different. It looks like it, but it's not really. That's what death confronts us with. Well, I think that's what James is saying here, that saying that we have faith, which is the theme that he's been exploring throughout this section, that's the outward form. That's like putting on the body. Okay? You say you got it, so you're wearing the right clothes here, but living it out, what he calls works, shows that the faith is alive, that it is real and living. to say I have it, that may or may not reflect reality. But to actually have faith, to actually believe the gospel, is going to have some sort of living impact on my life. And that's what he's saying. It's the difference between the dead body and the live one. Is the live one has that life in it. It's through its actions and movement you recognize there's someone in there. Well, it's through the lives that we live that we come to recognize there's a faith in there. Okay. I have one basic comment to make about what James is saying in this section. Well, first of all, let me review what we've seen. He's made a series of points here. Be warmed and filled. There he's talking about denying what you say by what you do. That there's this way that we recognize that I can live in such a way that gives the lie to whatever claim I'm making. And there's a way that I can live that gives the lie to the claim that I in fact believe the gospel. Then there's his discussion about the invisible man. What does a faith look like that has no visible impact in the life of the person who has that faith? How can I believe something and yet live entirely as if it were not true? And I think he's proposing you can't. It doesn't work that way. He talks about barren orthodoxy. The issue is not whether I have the right beliefs. The issue is whether I have submitted to the truth, whether I'm letting the truth of God bring me to repentance and trust. Then he talks about Abraham, which we talked about last time. Yes, he was justified by faith because he believed God's promise, but ultimately he showed that he really did believe by what he did. Rahab, no one asked her to sign a doctrinal statement. She showed what she believed about God by how she treated his people. And then finally, that difference between the outer form and the inner life, the dead body and the living one. A claim to believe is just the outward trappings. It is in the testing of our faith that our faith can be seen to be living and breathing. Okay, now, here's the point I want to make about this. Obviously, this is a section that I've talked about a lot. Yeah, you know, I wrote that book. And that book was about this stuff. So here I am again talking about the same stuff. But, in fact, I think this is a central thing. This is an important theme that we need to come to terms with as believers. I think it's getting to the point where I don't remember anymore, but I think in the book I mentioned one of my favorite little analogies that comes from Martin Luther, the picture of the drunk on the horse. Did I do that in the book? Does anybody remember? So you have a drunk sitting on a horse. He falls off on one side of the horse, and so he gets up swearing, I'm never going to fall off on that side of the horse again. So he falls off on the other side of the horse. It seems to me that there's a profound truth in that picture. And it seems to me that when it comes to this issue of faith and works, that it is easy for us to go wrong on either side. And it is important that we go wrong on neither side. I mean, this is a centrally important thing for us. On the one side is the problem of self-righteousness. It is so easy for us, it is so easy for us to judge other people, to think, I'm better than that person because they have this problem and I don't have that problem. It is easy to congratulate ourselves for doing what we consider to be the right when other people around us are not doing the right thing. So we do not understand the gospel if we don't understand the depth of the problem of evil that we're facing in ourselves. Every single day, if you're paying attention, you can find evidence in your life that you are a sinner. And if you're not paying attention, just ask the people around you, and they will be glad to point it out. I mean, every single day, I don't care who you are, every single one of us in here, let's just go on the assumption that every single one of us in this room is a believer. And I think, I mean, I know some of you, I've known you a long time, I've seen great works of God in the lives of many of the people here. that I think of as really mature, strong believers. And yet, the fact is that the evidence is still there every day that you are sinful people, and so am I. So, if we ever get the idea that somehow the reason that God is on my side is because I've got it together where everybody else doesn't, I have a big problem. Our works show us to be evil people, and our only hope is the cross of Christ. My only hope is that God is going to be merciful and not hold my life against me. That's the only hope I've got. If he makes me answer for it all, and let's just draw a line. Let's say God was, some theologies have said this sort of thing. You know, some theologies taught that when you got baptized, you were washed for all of the sins that you had committed up to that point, but then you're on your own for the ones that you committed after that. So this is true. This is literally true that there were people who would postpone getting baptized before they're on their deathbed. And they say, okay, quick, baptize me, so I don't have any opportunity to screw up after I've been baptized. Well, let's just draw the line right now. Okay, right here. Every single one of us is absolved from guilt for everything we've done up to this point. And we're all believers, so we ought to be in good shape, right? Would you take that deal from me? Would you say, every single sin from here back is forgiven, but from now on you'd better get it right? I wouldn't, because I would die. It's not going to work. So, the thing is that this idea that somehow there are works involved in the Christian faith is a very dangerous idea, because it can so easily lead us to think somehow, yeah, what we're looking for is that evidence that I've got it together, and I'm prepared to find evidence that I've got it together, and I'm prepared to find evidence that you don't, and here we are back once again at the old stand saying, God likes me better than he does you. That's not just a little problem. That is a fatal spiritual disease. We just can't go there. Our faith calls us to say, have mercy on me, a sinner. And to say, the only reason that I am going to survive this whole deal is because of what God did in Christ, and not anything that I've done on my own. But, on the other side, to be a person of faith is to be one who is justified before God. And faith is a living reality. It is not good works. I am not saying, and James is not saying, is that if you're a believer, then that means your life is going to be filled with good works and you won't find much sin going on in there. That's not his point. What he's saying is that my life is going to confront me with situations where I have to decide whether I really believe that stuff that I said I believed when I went forward or did whatever. That belief is the kind of thing you don't say, yes, I believe, and then move on and forget it. That in essence, I am constantly confronting the question in my life as it comes at me. Do I believe this stuff? That's what James is saying. And so my life, the circumstances of my life, are an opportunity for me to live with and have faith with my actions, to live out my faith. So God takes us through situations where we have to confront these things. We say we believe that we are sinners saved by grace, but God may take us through situations where we actually have to admit that we are in the wrong. Not just in theory, but actually in the midst of real life, say, I am in the wrong. Life may require us to be merciful to someone else because we believe God has been merciful to us. God may put us in a situation where someone does something against us, and we have to look at that, and we're forced to deal with the issue. Yes, what they did was wrong, but what about me? There, the issue of am I a sinner saved by grace has taken on weight and heft in my real life. Will I mess up? Yes. Will I struggle? Yes. Will it look bad along the way? Yes. But ultimately, I'm going to have to come to terms with this. Do I believe this stuff about me being a sinner or not? We say that we believe that God is good and trustworthy. But sometimes God takes us through hard times where we have to decide whether we in fact really do trust this God who has led my life in this direction. We say that we believe that we need salvation more than we need wealth. But sometimes God takes us through situations where we actually have to rubber meets the road, decide which is more important to me. So we can't fall off on this side of the horse either. The whole notion of justification by faith and justification by works, as James is spelling it out here, has this danger on either side. I cannot fall into self-righteousness and think that somehow that anything I do is earning me any place in God's favor. It is God's mercy that is bringing me there. But at the same time, I'm called to be a believer. And that means I'm called to be a believer when you sin against me. I'm called to be a believer when I lose my job. I'm called to be a believer when I really want something but I don't get it. I mean, in the midst of all of those circumstances, either I am going to continue to believe, and so you will see in the wrestlings and strivings and decisions that I make in my life that there is a dynamic faith that is at work in that process, or else it's just words. I say I believe, but in fact, what I believe much more deeply will show itself to be, I believe that riches are the most important thing. I believe that I'm a great guy and God's lucky to have me on his team and, you know, on and on. I would never say that stuff, but it's what I believe. And ultimately you come to see that it's the case. So we can't deny either side. They're not in conflict. Both of them are true. We can see how they fit together. But I have to make sure that I'm open to both of these truths. That on the one hand, my works, I'm not meriting God's favor, I'm not earning God's favor. There's nothing that I could do that would put me in God's favor. Jesus has done everything that needs to be done to put me in the place where I'm in the favor of God. And yet, on the other hand, it doesn't mean that I'm not called upon to do anything. I am. I'm called upon to believe. And to believe in a world like this means that I choose to believe when the pressure is on not to. And that means that the way I work, the way I do things, is going to be a believing way and not an unbelieving way. Both of those things are true. And if we miss either one of them, we're going to be in trouble. Okay, so we have time for some questions and comments. Have mercy on me, my brain is close to fried, so you can imagine the answer I would have given.
In verse 20,
yes.
6,
yes.
For just as the body without the spirit is dead, and also faith without works is dead. In that, that's an analogy, right?
Yeah.
So faith would be the body and works would be the spirit?
Yes. And that's why, and what I'm saying is the analogy is that faith there should be considered more to be that, what he starts out talking about at the beginning, what use is it if a man says he has faith? So faith here is the outer form. It's the, yes, I have embraced the idea that I'm a believer and that I belong with this group and so on. And it may include as much the sort of the theologically orthodox, yes, I could answer yes to all the right questions and that kind of stuff. But the works are, that's the action that arises out of the living reality of that faith instead of just being a front.
Okay. So if someone were to come along and say, just as the spirit enlivens the body, so do works enliven the faith, that's kind of, is that taking it too far? Or is his point just, as long as they're separated, it doesn't work?
Well, no, I think that would work fine, but that, again, I'm not thinking real well, but it seems to me like that phrase, the way you put it, is kind of ambiguous. Because what I'm afraid of is that idea that somehow what you need to do, what I'm saying to you is what you need to come to do is to add to your faith, make it living by going out and do something. And that's not what I'm saying. It's more, the idea is The analogy is kind of the dead body. The body has the outward form, but it has, you could put it this way, it has no works. It's not doing anything because there's no life in it. So in another way of thinking about it, the faith is the thing that gives life to the body, that gives life to the works. And that, I think that's, in some ways, that's a less misleading way to think about it.
Ron, I'd like to try to fine-tune the difference in the understanding of my sinfulness and the wrath of God. I have His grace. I've heard you recently talk about the presentation in early Romans where possibly we're not under the awful aspect of God's wrath. We have the benefit of His grace. Yet, as you say, right now, from this moment forward, I'm continuing to be sinful, and that sinfulness seems like some of those characteristics of placed by the wrath of God. And could you?
I see. You're talking about in Romans the idea God has given them over, that in His wrath. Yeah. That's a complex question. I can tell you how I think about it right now. I reserve the right to go back and think about this again, but that's always true. I think that the picture Paul's painting in Romans 1 is, if I look at mankind, we are rebels against God, and in that rebellion, you can see the fruit of that. We are cut off from, we are under the wrath of God, such that instead of God coming along and saying to mankind in general, oh, that's all right, let me fix you up here, He leaves us to just get worse and worse. I mean, what we need is the intervention of the Spirit to bring us around. Well, the believer is not abandoned to the wrath of God in that sense, in that I have the Spirit of God at work in me. I am no longer an enemy of God. I actually believe in Him. I don't reject the idea that He's there. I don't reject the idea that I'm a sinner, and so on. And so there is a real transformation that has begun in my life. There is a difference. I'm still wrestling with the problem of my own evil, my own selfishness, but in another sense, I have eyes to see. I mean, I can see that in fact I am that selfish sort of person. I mean, when you talk to some people about the problem, why they don't want to have anything to do with Christianity, sometimes people will just out and say things like, I don't believe people are evil, or I don't think I'm evil, I think I'm a good person, you know, or that sort of thing. Well, to take that attitude is to reflect that I am still under the wrath of God. I am blind. I am not seeing what's going on. The believer is actually in the spot where they can rightly recognize, for example, just this one example, no, there's something wrong here. So this all comes back to the distinction I tried to make in the title, Righteous Sinners, in that book, that we are sinners, but at the same time, there is something right that is happening in the lives of believers, and that is faith, or eyes to see, or whatever you might call it. I see the center of that focus being on the idea that we are open to the truth. I am not yet the sort of person that from my heart, easily and naturally, I am unselfish and totally loving of God and of my neighbor. But I have eyes to see enough that I can see something of how I'm not doing that, and I'm striving for it because I think that's what I ought to be. And so in all of that sense, I have been freed from the wrath of God. I have the after effects of living in this world and being a part of the curse that has come upon creation, but I'm being rescued from that. So it's still a tension. So, yeah, in that sense, I mean, it's a painful tension. I mean, if any of us who recognize some abiding sin in our life, something about us that we wish were not that way, I feel like, you know, I'm still under the wrath of God because, you know, why is it that way? But that's not the sign that I'm not under the wrath of God. The sign is that God is in fact opening my eyes to the truth about him, and I'm willing to submit to that truth.
Howdy, Ron.
Howdy.
Let's see. I was wondering if you could tell us if there is a difference between what a trespass is and what a sin is.
I was curious about that. Were you thinking, could you tell me what you were looking at?
Well, I wasn't looking at anything. I've just been thinking about this whole issue of, you know, forgiveness and sin and in between the lives of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, here's my personal example. I had my backpack stolen from my car in a downtown garage in Eugene the other day.
Mm.
And so I'm thinking, well, now, you know, do I forgive that person? At this point, not really. But even though this stuff is replaceable, I think, well, you know, they didn't go and get warmed and filled for my textbooks, I don't think.
Right.
Then I think, well, you know, it just gets me onto the whole subject of, you know, well, okay, I guess in my early Christian thinking, I think, oh, well, a trespass is not as bad as a sin. I mean, it's a little lighter shade of gray as opposed to sin, you know, which is has a little bit more black mixed in. And you know, it's a very childish sort of, you know, thing that I got going on. So I just was wondering if you could shed some light on it.
Well, probably not much.
Okay. Well, thank you anyway.
I think there's some fluidity to how those words are used, so it's a little hard to draw a line. I think I would say, fundamentally, when we're talking about the word trespass, the issue involved in a trespass is that there is some known issue, a commandment or something that I know I've been told not to do it, and I do it anyway. So I am trespassing. I am violating something that is not, I know I'm not supposed to violate. So trespass certainly comes under the category of sin. If I'm understanding Paul right in Romans 5, which is a very difficult chapter, but I think he's making this distinction where he's talking about, in essence, we would say Adam and Eve trespassed because they were told not to eat from the tree and they did. And then Moses came along and gave the law. And so in the law we have instructions, commandments. And so now I have more instructions that I can trespass against, that the Jews could trespass against, and so on. In between that period of time, between God saying, don't eat from this tree, and Moses giving the commandments of the law, Paul says sin was still in the world, but not trespass, because people were just doing their thing and they weren't really paying any attention to what God wanted or didn't even know necessarily, although to a certain extent they did. But I think what the issue, the distinction he's making there is we can think about sin as being just a principle of selfishness, of self-assertion, of refusal to submit to God, of putting my own needs and desires above those of other people and that sort of thing, to refuse my place that God has given me in the world. Trespass, as I understand the Bible using it, would be that principle manifesting itself in regard to specific commandments that I know I should keep but I don't. So I don't know how that relates to the way you were thinking about it, but there's no fundamental difference. I mean, a trespass, you know, like killing someone is a trespass. That's not a minor thing. You know, refusing to love God is a trespass at this point because we have plenty of understanding of that, what's required there. So no, they're both bad. I would recommend that you stay away from both of them.